Today is Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with John Weisheit, spelled W-E-I-S-H-E-I-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, John. How are you today?
Morning, Tom. I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Thank you. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. As we were wrapping up part 4, a couple of things we had talked about. One was your starting Living Rivers with Owen Lammers and David Brower in late 1999. And another thing I wanted to ask you about was a book that you wrote in the 1990s with Jane Belknap and Bob Webb, called Cataract Canyon. Could we back up a little bit and could you tell me a little bit about that book and how the project happened?
Sure, yes. Well, it started in 1992.
Okay.
In a way, it was a response to why aren't you doing comparative science above Glen Canyon Dam. And so a bunch of people did a river trip in 1992, I think it was. Bob Webb organized it. It had, I would come a little later at the request of Jane Belknap, who lives in Moab. You know, she's a neighbor,
okay,
essentially. Not a next door neighbor. And but on that trip, you know, there were people like Jack Schmidt and Ted Mellis and Richard Valdez and Larry Stevens, and they all did this river trip, you know, in Cataract Canyon. Robert Webb started doing repeat photography as he had done in the Grand Canyon, using photos mostly from Powell, which would be 1871, and Franklin Nims, Robert Brewster Stanton's photos from 1889. You know, so the idea is, you know, so here's how things have changed in Grand Canyon. Now we're going to go above Glen Canyon Dam, and here's how things have changed in Cataract Canyon above Lake Powell. I don't think that effort actually got any traction as far as that original community, other than, you know, for example, you know, Jack Schmidt does show up in Canyonlands from time to time, even very recently. And the fish people are, of course, up here because the Upper Colorado River Recovery Program started officially, I think, in 1989. You know, so the Upper Basin started getting some attention. You know, it was actually a recommendation of National Academy of Sciences to, that, you know, to understand Grand Canyon below Lake Glen Canyon Dam, you got to understand it above. You know, it actually says, you know, you need to do science in Cataract Canyon.
So, John, looking above Glen Canyon Dam, the first thing, of course, that comes to mind is not so much Cataract Canyon, but Glen Canyon. Was Glen Canyon included in this as Mellis and Schmidt and Stevens and Webb went through Cataract Canyon? Were they looking at Glen as well? Were they thinking about that?
No, except for the reach above Lees Ferry.
Okay.
But that's part of the adaptive management program.
And below the dam, that's not looking at the resource above the dam.
The adaptive management program does look at the forebay of Glen Canyon Dam. They monitor water quality. That work is largely done by Bill Verneau.
Okay.
But beyond the forebay, then it becomes all that science is largely done by people like Mark Anderson from Glen Canyon National Recreation Area.
Okay.
And others. But Lake Powell has gotten a lot of other interests. You know, there's been like Duke University, Lincoln Pratson had started doing bathymetry, for example, measuring the sediment content that's filling in Lake Powell.
Okay.
The USGS, like Bob Hart and Flagstaff, did some geochemistry of sediment in the height area.
Okay, so it looked like Powell was getting some attention, but Cataract was not.
Not really. of course, the endangered fish program started in full force once they got their contracts signed by the states and got their funding.
Okay.
To this day, they're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the interesting thing about Cataract is we have all four species of the endangered fish list. The humpback chubs are monitored as well. You know, they're all there. They're not in great numbers, but at least they're present.
Okay.
The Park Service does a lot of water quality, mostly for fecal chloroform, just for health reasons to keep visitors happy, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Getting sick, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so after this trip in 92, how did the book then come out of that?
Well, so Bob just, you know, he says, I'm going to, you know, matching photos takes forever.
Hmm.
And everybody else is busy. And Bob latches on to Jane, because Jane's a resource specialist in Canyonlands National Park.
Okay.
She now transferred over from the park to the United States Geological Survey, the biological division, which was one of the changes that Bruce Babbitt made when he was Secretary of Interior, was start looking at biological components and not just physical things that the USGS typically does. And so the two of them decided to continue doing their research, and they needed a boatman and somebody with, you know, skills or whatever, I guess. Then that became me.
Okay.
You know, because Jane insisted. Jane and I had done Park Service trips, and she kind of handpicked me, I think you could say. And so I just volunteered, and I just put all my, you know, I never got paid for it. I just did it. You know, if I needed a boat, I used my own. If I didn't, I would use a company boat.
Mm-hmm.
Pro bono. And I think, oh my, we must have done, we worked, so from like 1992 to like 2002, we did river trips. And we didn't, the book wasn't published till 2004. But for 12 years, we matched photos. We did vegetation transects. We did analysis of physical characteristics of change. You know, how we did that, you know, we had 8x11 photos. We had a punch. You know, we would punch a hole through like a rock that, let's say a rock moved. We would punch a hole through that rock, and on the back we would write, this rock has moved.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then we did, you know, we had to GPS the site, pound in some rebar to mark the site, so that, because, you know, quite frankly, it's time to do it again, because there's been noticeable changes since Bob and I did this with Jane back in the early 90s.
Okay.
So, you know, what the camera never lies. You know, the camera is a great tool. You know, and in this place, it hasn't changed a lot, but it's certain components of it have changed a lot, like tamarisk,
Okay.
channel narrowing. It's changed again because now in 2006, they introduced the tamarisk beetle as a biological control to control non-native growth of tamarisk, and it's changing again.
Okay.
You know, so
You mentioned channel narrowing. Is that happening with side material being washed in and lacking a major flushing force from up basin, or is there something else happening with that?
well, that's actually what Jack Schmidt's been doing with his graduate students. We noticed it from just the photo that we took, how much the river is narrowing. That's because there, I would say the main reason is there's dams upstream that are controlling the flood regime.
Okay.
So we've lost our ability to scour.
Okay.
Scour is important because that's actually, you know, we think of it as floods as a big pain in the ass, but it's nature's haircut. It's nature's, it's how it rejuvenates itself. Everything's adapted to drought and flood regimes, biologically, genetically. And so we've altered that. And so, of course, it's going to get narrower. It allows vegetation to creep in. And the dominant vegetative seed is windblown tamarisk trees. But so, you know, our rivers are getting narrow. It's really apparent on the Dolores River, for example.
Okay.
You can't even camp anymore on the Dolores. When the river does rise, when there's a spill at McPhee, you know, there's no place to camp because it's all vegetation encroached.
Okay. And that same phenomena is happening in Grand Canyon below Glen Canyon Dam, and in Lodore and Split Mountain, basically any reach of the river below a major dam, this encroachment down to a new flow regime level.
Well, yeah, you know, that brings up a good point because I'll never forget this. Bob, you know, he spent all this time and money and research during the GCES program in Grand Canyon, and he comes up to Cataract Canyon, and I overheard him say this. He was kind of like talking to himself, but it was overheard. And he said this, "I should have came here first." And then in the late 90s, excuse me, in the late 90s, Bob and I, Jane didn't in, was not involved in this. We went into Desso.
Okay.
And I overheard Bob say the very same thing. He said, this is what he said, "I should have started here first." So, you know, it's interesting. It turns out that place that probably is the most interesting landscape in the entire basin is Desolation Gray, because it has Cenozoic rock. It's you know, a lot of the erosion that's happened on the Colorado Plateau has removed a lot, you know, all of the Cenozoic. Grand Canyon, you know, there's no Mesozoic. All there is Paleozoic and Protozoic. But in Deso, you have all that Cenozoic rock. You know, it kind of helps you put the picture together. And so,
how is that? How is the Cenozoic rock type important in this way? I'm not.
Well, the Cenozoic rocks are leucostream. They're freshwater limestones.
Okay.
They're not. There's no marine deposits. You know, so there's this marine rock history, which is, you know, what you see when you do Grand Canyon and Cataract Canyon.
Right.
But here's a freshwater limestone. You know, in other words, the ocean isn't present anymore. There's a river and lake system on the Colorado River Basin. Most of the flow is going northwest instead of southeast. I mean, now it goes southwest, but back then it went northwest.
Okay.
So, you know, you're going, oh, wow. You know, you would never know this geologic history if you didn't do a Desolation Gray Canyon trip.
How does that impact the channel morphology for vegetation and you know, channel width, et cetera?
Good question, because, so Bob and I are matching Powell photos, Stone Cogswell photos,
Cold
photos, and we're doing our vegetation transects and whatnot, and we begin to realize that there's more cottonwoods in Desolation Canyon now than there was in 1907. You know, so why is that? You know, every other canyon, cottonwoods and Gooding willows are in decline. And that's changed. I'm glad I Gooding's willows. We don't call them that up here. We call them peach leaf willows.
Okay.
But they're just off the charts, Tom. There was a time I could count peach leaf willows on a Cataract Canyon trip in my two hands. Most of them are at the confluence of the Green and the Colorado.
Okay.
But they're everywhere now. There are sandbar islands with nothing but peach leaf willows. You know, that isn't a 21st century phenomenon that I haven't been able to explain. So, you know, here's the point, Tom. You're not supposed to see this kind of dramatic shifts and changes in one human lifetime. You know, so between dams and a changing climate, it is so obvious, you know.
Okay.
It's like a soldier on the front lines of World War I. Like, this is really happening.
What was the name of the book you finally published? What's the full title?
Cataract Canyon, A Human and Environmental History of the Rivers in Canyonlands. It's University of Utah Press.
Thank you. And that came out in 2004?
Yes.
Okay. And was this the sort of the major takeaway that you saw in Cataract Canyon as well? Was this dramatic changing in the scope of human lifetime?
You know, so we had a lot of private time with very smart scientists, you know, and it changed me, I have to say, forever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, this is 22, 23 years ago, we were having conversations about the seriousness of climate change back then. You know, because how could you not talk about it? It's right in front of you. You know, dead pinyon pine trees that were once thriving. I mean, it's already arid. Now it's really arid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think you can call The word drought doesn't apply to the Colorado Plateau at all. It's always in drought, 24/7, 365.
Right. It's a high desert.
Yeah. You know, it's arid, and it's getting more arid. And it's getting hotter. I don't think the summers are hotter, but the winters are. That's what's different. The winters are different. For example, there were a lot of biting cold periods in the 19th century that, you know, we were leaving the Little Ice Age in the 19th century. And freezing really affects cactus growth. And one of the things we noticed is the cactus patches became bigger and healthier through the 20th century. You know, so it's been warming, actually, for 150 years. And the trend has not reversed.
Right. I wanted to go back for a minute to the increased cottonwood growth as compared to 1907. And I wondered about that snapshot. There was some major flooding that occurred in the basin before 1907. And would you expect to see an increase in large trees along the rivers, whether they be the peach leaf willow or the cottonwood, simply because the dam construction has removed major flooding combined with 100 years from 1907 to 2007, or even on to today, of limited flooding, flooding events. And so would that be a contributing factor as well to vegetative changes that one might see?
That's a good question. So the floods definitely help trees. For example, the University of Arizona has a dendrochronology lab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David Miko, Connie Woodhouse, and we got one of their staff, Alex McCord, we were doing core samplings of trees along the corridor of the river.
Uh-huh.
And especially netleaf hackberry, which is a, what is that? Get what family it is. elm. It's an elm.
All right.
It's a native plant. It likes the flood regime zone. And so we started coring, you know, those trees. The reason why is there's a pronounced line, horizontal line in Cataract Canyon of just abundant hackberries there. Can almost draw a straight line on a plane table and a T-square. I mean, that's how you can tell it was a high flood event. So we started coring these hackberry trees to see when they germinated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was 1804. It might have been 1802. I can't remember. That's when they germinated. So there was a big flood. And to this day, there's no 20th century flood has ever been as high as those hackberry trees. You know, and actually, there's a stand of hackberries above that line, which indicates, you know, that's where a photograph from John Wesley Powell, Beeman.
Okay.
So there, this is 1871. This is the second expedition. They camped on the left side at Tilted Park below Rapid 9. And they took a photograph of a cottonwood tree that had, there was a bunch of driftwood, float driftwood, that was jammed and pressed against the trunk of this cottonwood tree. And so, first of all, there was a big flood. I mean, it's Bob and I and Jane found this tree. It's a carcass now. It's fallen. It's still there, though. But, you know, there something planted that cottonwood tree. And by the way, that cottonwood tree is well beyond the 20th century tamarisk tree line.
Okay.
There's no tamarisks in sight. So no flood in the post-tamarisk invasion has ever been to this location since.
Hmm.
So something, some big flood, of course, planted that cottonwood tree. It might have been the floods of the early 19th century, you know, like the 1802 or 04, I can't remember which one. Something planted those cottonwood trees, and then another one came by that was bigger, that was sufficient to plant drift on, plaster it on a trunk of the tree.
Right, higher up than that.
And it got Powell's attention.
Hmm.
You know, so Bob and I started looking at the diaries. Powell doesn't talk about it, but Dellenbaugh does.
Hmm.
Sumner does. Bradley does. And they all talk about, Dellenbaugh talks about this, what we would call a paleo flood indicator, you know, a scour line, a driftwood line that was 50 feet above where they were in 1871,
mm-hmm.
which was a summer. I think it was June, or it must have been July. Low water. And George Bradley is talking about, oh boy, how fun the rapids must be. And John Sumner saying things like, he, you know, such high flows would obviously flip boats and drown you and wouldn't be so fun. I always like George Bradley's optimism compared to Sumner's pessimism.
Hmm.
But anyway, so yeah, so
so flooding is going to impact the vegetation. It sounds like as far as both removing trees that are near the water's edge and by severe inundation and planting trees at the flood line.
Yeah, because it mobilizes seeds. You know, cottonwoods can clone. You know, bury a branch and sediment, and it'll grow into a tree.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need a seed.
Right.
So floods, yeah, floods take trees away and plant new ones. It, like I said, it's a haircut.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's part of the regime. It's natural. It's supposed to happen. You know, floods and droughts have been happening for 6 million years in the Colorado River Basin.
Right, right.
And they never hurt anybody until, but now they do hurt people because we've done the foolish thing of building in the floodplain. And we think we're safe to do that because we built these dams. But when these big floods of the 19th century come back, you know, there's going to be some damn spillway failures.
Hmm.
And floods are going to be twice the magnitude because it's got the contents of a reservoir coming down with it.
Right. If a reservoir fails, the impoundment behind the reservoir joins the flood and,
yeah,
and just enlarges the flood size.
So that's hmm. not a haircut. That's a that's a shave. So yeah, I mean, you know, we're we have some unpleasant surprises before us coming our way, and that's what I learned. That's what happens when you look at nature. But to do that, you have to get off your ass and get on a boat and get go, you know, and get down the river.
Right, gotta get out and look at the resource and try to figure it out. So how did, so was the work on the book, Cataract Canyon, was that another component that helped in the formation of Living Rivers then in 1999-2000.
Yes, very much so, because that's, you know, I got introduced to John Dornwind, who was a retired USGS scientist at Menlo Park, you know, which is the USGS think tank.
Okay.
And a very highly intelligent person John was, and he was an associate professor at the University of Arizona working with Vic Baker. That's how I got introduced to paleo flood hydrology, because, you know, essentially what Bob, Jane, and I were doing was citizen science, you know, really, you know, it was kind of like, we're going to do this, whether it's supported by or not, even though they were USGS employees. So they were on salary, is what I'm saying, but I wasn't. So, you know, we kind of got, Living Rivers got into the citizen science thing. Because John Dornwind told me, you know, John, when the government doesn't do the science, then the citizens got to do it themselves. And so, it was, by the way, that's when the EIS to remove the pile or not was happening here in Moab. You know, we have the second largest uranium waste heap in the country, right next to the Colorado River.
Right.
Then they did no, they, meaning the Department of Energy, did no assessment, physical assessment of floods.
Hmm.
They did a statistical analysis. The USGS did it for it. The statistical analysis was that, yes, you could have a 300,000 cubic foot per second flood every 10,000 years. This pile needs to go because it's going to be radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years.
Okay.
But you know, so we're going, we need physical evidence of floods, and that's what the University of Arizona is famous for. That, you know, that's the life ambition of Vic Baker, who is the professor who was on Bob Webb's PhD committee, Ted Mellis's committee. I mean, this guy has educated so many famous scientists.
Hmm.
You know, he's an amazing person. And so John Dornwind and Vic took me to the next level. And we're looking at strictly paleo flood deposits because this pile needs to go. And so here's what we found: is we had the statistical analysis of one every 10,000 years is completely wrong, because we had 44 floods in 2,000 years, and three of them were over the statistical assessment.
Okay.
So in other words, we had floods over or slightly under 300,000 cubic feet per second happening three times in the last 2,000 years. So you know, you have to realize I'm digging a trench 60 feet above the river.
Wow.
And you know, and you look at, you know, we're doing what tree ring scientists, dendrochronologists do.
Uh-huh.
You know, they look at the layers of tree rings.
Right.
You know, so a paleo flood hydrology researcher looks at the ring, you know, the layers of successive floods. But you got to dig a trench.
Mm.
You got to photograph it. Hopefully you'll find some charcoal or some wood or some air, and hopefully you'll, and then you'll do some, you need some good sand quartz crystals so you can do OSL, optical luminescence, optical stimulation luminescence. So anyway, yeah, so, you know, and so we, you know, we found one of the best paleo flood deposits in the entire Colorado River Basin in Arches National Park. Along the Colorado River Road, right very close to the BLM takeout for the Colorado River Daily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we wrote a grant. And it was $40,000, and we spent every dime, and we produced a report, and we didn't publish a formal peer-reviewed paper till 2014. The project started in 2005.
Okay.
So science takes time.
Yeah. So the flood deposits, there's a side canyon that comes in to the Colorado River in that Moab Daily section that backs up into most of Arches.
Salt Creek.
And it occurred to me that there may be, you know, deposits up in there. We have flood deposits mapped and marked in a lot of different places that one could go look for.
There are, very observant, Tom. There are deposits up there. They're not... We did visit that site. There's cultural things there, too.
So oh, okay.
We decided, they're there, but they're not ideal.
Okay. Yeah.
But the one, the one we found was, like, the best.
Great.
We were just really, you know, what was funny is because we're, like, our reconnaissance ended at the BLM takeout.
Okay.
No, and we didn't. We had some deposits, but not some really good ones. And we were kind of disappointed because, you know, we're looking at the boat ramp, like, oh shit, we didn't really find anything. And then and then Noam Greenbaum, who's on the boat with me from Israel, he goes, "Stop!" So, and he climbs up there and he goes, "This is it." And it was. It's an amazing sight. Just absolutely amazing.
And when was that you found that site?
2005.
Okay.
Yeah, we got the money. I went to University of Arizona at the Harshberger building and had a talk with Noam and Vic, and we just went for it. They wanted to do it. They were really excited about it.
So by 2005, you'd already started Living Rivers. Can you back up a little bit and talk about that and how it was you started selling ice cream?
Oh, yeah, so it's 1999. We kind of had marching orders from Broward to start an organization. Owen was executive director of International Rivers Network. He quit. He resigned. He got a severance package. It wasn't large. It was like $20,000. And Owen and I are going up and down Main Street looking for a potential office for what was then called Glen Canyon Action Network. That's what Brower wanted the organization to be called.
Okay.
And there's an abandoned ice cream store. It used to be called LaSalle Ice Cream Shoppers. It's right underneath the rental units that Edward Abbey used to hang out in long ago. And right on Main Street and Center Street. You know, the most ideal location in all of Moab. And it had been... We peered inside the windows, and the ice cream refrigerator is still in there. And Owen goes, "Let's sell ice cream." And it was a front. It was, you know, we will sell ice cream. We'll name the city. We'll get 16 flavors. We'll name them. That's how many tubs fit into the freezer. We'll name them after characters of Monkey Wrench Gang and other books, you know. So we had, like, Brower's Bear Claw, Seldom Seen's cookies and cream. You know, so, and then inside we had all our propaganda. We had Drain It TV. We played videos of Glen Canyon before it was inundated. Was a long office. You know, it was only maybe like 20 feet wide and maybe 100 feet long.
Okay.
We had all our computers and our phones and file cabinets in the back. We had a kitchen with a sink for cleanup, and so we made enough money to pay rent. The ice cream sold enough money to make pay our rent and two salaries.
Wow.
So we were capitalist environmentalists, I guess.
So I would imagine that ice cream sales were pretty good in the summer, but in the winter, it's kind of...
Yeah, we shut it down.
Okay.
You know, so when you have a public presence like that, people are curious. They want to stop and look and talk.
Hmm.
You know, so we were forced to do public relations. It was great training. Activists would, you know, it felt like a comfortable place to just, you know, shoot the shit and strategize. And, you know, Moab has a lot of nonprofits. So we were kind of like a hub. In a lot of ways, it was distracting. We couldn't get our work done.
Right.
We had to work long hours to catch up. But, you know, I don't think we did anything wrong. It's just, but I did think this won't last forever. And we did stop in this year of the winter of 2005-2006 for three reasons. One, the other retailers on Main Street corridor didn't really like us being there. And so they all started selling ice cream in these little cabinet freezers that are like 2 feet by 3 feet. And so, and then an ice cream store franchise came in. And, you know, our business profits were dropping significantly. And because we weren't the only ice cream store in town anymore.
Okay.
Two, they're going to rip up Main Street, and put in concrete, new sewers, new, you know, all that. But Owen and I also knew that the economy was going to crash, and so, which it did. And so, you know, we decided that we're going to start working at home.
Okay. You know, it's interesting thinking about how to be productive for a mission and not lose money. And yet, as you said, that the store was a great way to educate the public.
Oh, it was. Absolutely.
So there's a trade-off in there. In the end, now, 2019, looking back, you know, the economy tanked, certainly by 2008, but came back. Now, of course, Moab is just off the charts, popular with all kinds of people flooding through town all times of the year. Do you still think that was the best way to proceed there? You know, at the time, I think it certainly made sense. I'm just kind of wondering if there's any other thoughts you have on that, looking back now.
Well, the campaign to drain Lake Powell was, first of all, it was a decade of discovery.
Okay, how so?
It was more about what we didn't know. You know, so we started this organization with these conceived notions of you know, this dam just needs to go away. You know, it's impacting Grand Canyon. It's not really justified, you know, let's take this thing down, just, you know. And we're starting, you have to realize that the timing was perfect because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was issuing jeopardy opinions for Flaming Gorge, the Aspinall Unit, Navajo Dam, and of course Glen Canyon Dam, and so the Bureau of Reclamation was initiating EISs for all these dam operations.
Okay.
And we were there, and we just one comment letter, NEPA process after another, and we were building what David Brower told us we needed to do, which was demonstrate legal standing to intervene in Glen Canyon Dam, Flaming Gorge Dam operations at all. And so we started doing that, but, you know, and the internet is maturing, documents are, showing up that for public review, and, you know, I'm reading and I'm learning, shoot, man, I found out, you know, the administrative record showed that Glen Canyon Dam has always been controversial, and it wasn't a partisan thing. It was a resource economics thing, you know, like, this dam, we don't really need this dam.
Right.
And I'm going, oh, wow, we're just reigniting an existing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, you learn about Northcutt Ely, you learn about David Brower, you learn about Jeff Ingram, you're realizing that you're just standing on other people's shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was humbling, you know, and so now it's like, well, we've always been aware of this. This isn't new. This, you know, there have been people who've been trying to do the right thing for a long time.
Mm, right.
You know, so now the scientists they've always been involved, but now they're really involved because they've all had a glimpse of the future. And this infrastructure that we built in the 20th century is not going to take us into the 21st century. You know, so we did the best we could with what we had, but the infrastructure is wrong. The legal framework is wrong. It's not going to work. Actually, I am so sure about this. Climate doesn't matter anymore. I mean, this is... We have never adapted. I think I've already said this. We've never adapted to climate. And, you know, to adapt a climate means you change everything. And we had to pull teeth to get the funding to put what we've got in. And now we're going to have to change it. And believe me, it's going to cost 2 to 5 times more. And there's just not those kind of financial resources. So we truly are between a rock and a hard place.
Okay.
And nature will win.
Right. So to try to kind of paraphrase what you're saying is the dam was built under contentious circumstances. It used 19th and 20th century technologies. And the place we find ourselves today is where the agencies have recognized the troubles with the construction and the premise of water management. To change that is going to be very expensive. and we don't have the funds to do it. Is that?
Yeah, the richest country in the world can't afford this.
Hmm. So we basically are going to wait until a very large hydraulic event occurs that will not only give a haircut, but will do the Yul Brynner thing of stripping down to a bald surface.
Yeah, it's not just floods, though. I mean, a 300-year warming trend like what happened between year 900 and 1300, the medieval warming period.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, how do you, so you have these extremes. And when the extremes come, the infrastructure fails.
Right.
And the legal system fails. Everybody wants to avoid going to Supreme Court, but I can guarantee you that's where it's going.
Hmm. Okay. How so?
Because you have the prior appropriation doctrine. You know, this goes back to Powell. Powell said, you know, prior appropriation isn't going to work. It's going to create a structure of haves and have-nots.
So hang on for a minute. Prior appropriation, is that the first-in-time, first-in-line concept?
Yeah. The bullshit mantra?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which basically says, I got here first, I was using the water first, so whatever water there is, I need to get mine before anybody else gets theirs. And the second person says, well, the first person's got theirs, so I'm the second, so I get mine, and whatever's left will go to the third person.
And then the Indian shows up.
Well, and the Native Americans say, well, we were here first, so we are first. Meanwhile, populations grow and grow. Cities have sprung up in the last 20 and 30 years, outskirts of major towns are now major towns in and of themselves. So how is this headed to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so everybody knows the famous quote from John Wesley Powell that they're building a heritage of conflict, and that's what he was talking about.
Okay.
You know, this is going to end up in the judicial system.
Oh, it has already. Yeah.
Okay, so John Wesley Powell was a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
He was right, everybody else is wrong. Okay, well, what, you know, so what? But, you know, think about it. We have a treaty with Mexico. They're at the very end of the system. They get their 1.5 million acre feet no matter what. Unless they decide to be nice. I mean, even California, who has these rock solid, hard, you know, large quantity prior appropriation allocations, you know, even they have to give their water to Mexico if it's required. So Mexico's at the top of the prior appropriation by treaty. It's an international treaty.
Okay.
So that's 1.5 million acre feet. And then the next in line is the tribes. And to this day, they don't have their full allocation. You know, they should, you know, if in 1922, this is what they should have said. They should have said, we need to take care of the tribes in Mexico first, and then the states.
Hmm.
That didn't happen. It went, the states get this, and we'll worry about Mexico and the Indians later. And okay, that was the first mistake. So they were, you know, it was definitely colonialism. It's water colonialism.
Sure.
And we're, you know, that has changed in the last 100 years, colonialism, but not water colonialism. It's the same. It's no different than it was with nations in the 19th century.
So I'm curious, in the Supreme Court journey, who's going to be suing who, and what's going to be the matter that will need to be settled? Clearly, there are many, but.
Well, yeah, so you have these large, so the prior appropriation system has put these few people with huge amounts of water. They're not even part of the 1922 compact. I forgot the word. The 1922 compact is the distribution of an allocation of water after 1922, not before 1922. So these people get their water, and the reservoirs are going empty. Hydropower contracts, by the way, it's not when it goes bone dry, it's when hydropower stops. Because that's the first contract violation.
Can you explain that a little bit?
So there are these, well, it's called the water and power contracts. The Boulder Canyon Project Act that created the All-American Canal and Hoover Dam has created a lot of other things. Water and power contracts. A lot of it went to the Metropolitan Water District to pump that water to the coastal basin.
So this is moving Colorado River water to Los Angeles, out on the California coast. The coastal basin is your, okay, and that would have been arranged through these water and power contracts, okay.
And that's where North Cut Ely comes in. And this is the Hoover administration. And don't forget, Roosevelt wasn't president till January of 1933. So a lot of this was done during the Hoover administration. And, Arizona got a contract. Nevada has, a lot of people wonder why Nevada's water allocation is so low. Because what they really wanted was more hydropower. So it's not a lot, but they have more. Nevada has more hydropower in their contract than Arizona does. But the bulk of it goes to the Metropolitan Water District. And now, the federal government built Hoover Dam, but the Metropolitan Water District helped. It was built. I'm talking about Davis Dam and Parker Dam.
Right, downstream of Hoover Dam.
Yeah, funding for that came from the Metropolitan Water District.
Okay.
So they were built by the Bureau, or designed by the Bureau, largely funded by Metropolitan. So a lot of that power from Parker Dam and Davis Dam goes to pumping the canal, the Colorado River Aqueduct to the Los Angeles County, Orange County, and San Diego County. 20 million people rely on that aqueduct.
Well, isn't this one of the premises of Northcutt Ely, who said, we're going to grow, and if all the states take their allocated waters, we're going to be out of water.
Yeah, he knew that the compact allocation was over budget. They knew that in 1928. There was the Siebert report. So Siebert, so General Colonel William, I think his first name was, they started the Hoover Dam Commission. Elwood Mead is part of this,
Okay.
and others. There were like 3 Meads on this committee, but none of them were related. It was a huge coincidence. And anyway, they said, in that report, it's like the year is 1928, it says you don't have 17.5 million acre feet. You have probably 15. So you need, in the years to, and it, you need to take care of Mexico.
Okay.
You you gotta quit putting this one off. So, you know, it's like, so, I mean, everything was on the table before the Depression even started.
Okay.
Everybody, I mean, people, the resource managers knew, oh, shit, we blew this one. We got it. What are we going to do? You know, we need to start over, but they never did.
So the overallocation of the resource being water, combined with closing in now on 100 years of population growth, by an order of, what, 7, 8 times, sets us up for a condition where there's not enough water to go around.
No, there's not. And, you know, if you look at the Colorado River long-term profile, you know, every 50 years it drops 1 million acre feet. And you look at the basin study, that's going to continue to the end of the 21st century, you know. You look at the science, you know, there's only going to be, pretty soon there's only going to be 12 million acre feet left, and then we're, in our children's lifetime, they're going to have to deal with 10. For contracts that allocate 17.5, I mean, this thing breaks. There's going to be, they think the magic wand is, let's just pipe water from the Columbia.
Right.
And everything will be fine, but the growth will continue and we'll run out of water yet again.
Right.
You know, so it's a cancer. It's a malignant cancer.
Well, that concept of piping water from the Columbia has been around for almost 100 years as well. And of course, the Pacific Northwest is not real keen about participating in that journey. Again, who's going to pay for it? And you have to build an infrastructure that can tolerate the serious environmental swings. We've learned that, if that's a lesson, I think we've learned, as we've done these studies to look at what the peak maximum flows can be over 2 and 5 and 10,000 years, and they're fairly stunning amounts. So if you have to build to survive that, again, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and it's easy to solve if you just follow this one concept, which is work with nature instead of trying to conquer nature.
Ah.
We chose to conquer. We're colonialists. It's in our blood. You know, and so until we get rid of this mentality, remember I was telling you how I don't like this country, Tom. This is why. We're conquerors. We even conquer nature. And nature is patient, but eventually it sends the ultimate message.
Right.
You can have no more. We're going to force it. So, yeah, so of course we're being, you know, for 6 million years, nature never really hurt mankind until we built skyscrapers 20 feet away from the ocean.
Right.
We put dams in with spillways that can't handle nature's flood cycle. And we don't have a way to evacuate sediment out of these reservoirs. I mean, it all comes to an end.
Right.
And we shouldn't be arguing about who gets what. We need to be having discussions about when we get nothing, because the infrastructure doesn't work that way.
So given the infrastructure that we have, the hard structures on the rivers, it would seem that the easiest thing to do, which of course would be a legal nightmare, would be to revisit the 1923 compact, the 22 compact. To say, okay, we overshot there. We don't have the water we thought we did. We are going to now have to learn to live with less. Do you see that as a viable journey?
Yes. It's the most productive thing we can do,
Okay.
is to admit our mistakes and do the self-correct.
So if we looked at revisiting the compact, okay, let's go to 14 million acre feet as a target goal, maybe heading to 10, given continued forecasted drought. Where would dam removal fit into this? Would you then be able to say the delivery point of the upper basin to the lower basin states is going to be at Hoover Dam?
No, I think, well, you need to get rid of that thing. That was a compromise. They couldn't, in 1922, they couldn't agree on who gets what. So the negotiations were about to fail. And Dave
Right.
Carpenter said, okay, well, here's an idea. Let's divide the basin and we'll worry about it later.
Okay.
Well, they've been doing that ever since. They will worry about this later.
Okay.
So they kicked, it's a contract to guarantee can kicking down the road.
Okay. So would you then say, all right, we have count out the states, Arizona, California, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico. Thank you. Everybody needs some, or everybody claims some. Of course, there's also Mexico. There's the First Nations, whose boundaries cross the state boundaries.
That's true.
So here are the players, and everybody's looking for a piece of the pie. So we're going to eliminate upper basin, lower basin. We're going to say this is the basin. So it's a basin-wide vision. How would that basin-wide vision look at the current infrastructure?
Yeah, so well, let's go back to Glen Canyon Dam. North Cudahy said, this is really stupid. Don't build this thing. Dams don't make water. I mean, that dam isn't about water. It's about a compact that is a compromise, which means Glen Canyon Dam is a compromise structure decision. So compromise, isn't determinant. It's not something that, just get rid of that damn thing.
Well, would you make the same case for McPhee on the Dolores and
Absolutely, yeah.
Navajo on the San Juan and Flaming Gorge and Fontanelle on the Green? And the infrastructures and the resources that draw water on the river would say, wait a minute, we put these structures in here for, the typical speech that the dam builders give, which is trying to meter out water instead of going from flood to flood.
Yeah, so let's go to need and purpose.
Okay.
Why was Hoover Dam built? Okay, two problems. The Colorado River flow diminished right when the harvest was at its peak, when the plants needed the most water they could to get to harvest. Number two, there was so much sediment coming down, they had to 24/7 dredge all the canals. Number three, flood come by and Colorado River leaves its channel and fills up the Salton Trough.
Right.
So you need to store water so we can grow food, especially in the south part of the basin, because they have a growing season of 12 months. Number two, this is a dirty river. It's got a lot of sediment, and we need to store that sediment in these reservoirs. And incidentally, we won't create a way to get rid of it.
Right.
And we need flood control, but then, which is fine. But then the hydropower thing comes about, and hydropower works really well when reservoirs are full. So they like to keep those reservoirs full, which means you really don't have flood control. So they trade off flood control for hydropower productivity. So, you know, all the needs and purposes have been altered. You know, so yeah, I mean, I understand that, you know, if you're going to grow local food in the Colorado River Basin, you're going to need storage. I understand that.
Well, it's interesting looking at, you know, you mentioned need and purpose, which was irrigation, sediment control, flood control, and right away that need and purpose was also straddled with feeding a growing population, as you mentioned, in the coastal valleys. So now we're taking water out of the basin into far parts of California and growing a huge civilization over there. Now that's wrapped into Hoover Dam as well. And the other dams, constructions above Hoover Dam, you know, if anything, they weren't for irrigation. They certainly did sediment control. They helped with flood control, but they cranked out hydroelectricity.
Yep, to pay for it all.
Right. And there are not a lot of straws. There's not a huge amount of water diversion happening anywhere in the upper basin, except for the Colorado Continental Divide, where a good amount of Colorado River goes to the Front Range, Denver and Colorado Springs and Pueblo.
Yeah.
Water's heading that way. So again, it's like, well, we got this system and we're thirsty over here, so we're gonna use our allotment from the 22 Compact. We're gonna grab that water over here. So I'm just trying to tease out what the way forward is, because we will go to court and we'll go to the Supreme Court, but Supreme Court is questionable whether they will take into consideration the shorts.
That's a huge possibility. In fact, that's what I bet that happens. The Supreme Court will say, look, you were here once before. We're not going to hear. You need to figure this one out yourself.
Right.
Because you're not going to like our decision. So why don't you just, you know, so that's probably what's going to happen. But there is going to be water quality lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be ESA lawsuits. The citizens are going to say, wait a minute, the commons are being destroyed here.
Right.
And there will be, you know, that's why I like filing lawsuits. It's the only way the citizens have the right to say, wait a minute.
Right.
Because we don't have an allocation. But there's also one other need and purpose thing that we forgot about, which is the manifest destiny.
Okay.
You know, because the arid lands had nobody in it. And we got this thing from Mexico, huge chunk of land. Nobody's in it. How are we going to secure our borders? So it's a homeland security thing. That's the ultimate need and purpose. We need to fill this place. Well, to fill this place, we need railroads. We need dams.
We right. need,
you know, and so, you know, the ultimate need and purpose is securing our borders.
Well, I think of conquest, that the concept of conquest, either of others who are outside of us, or conquest of nature. And as you mentioned, nature bats last. So if we're unwilling to realize that the Colorado River Basin is mostly desert, which cannot sustain the populations that we've put in it. And the biggest migration in the history of our species, I believe, is to the southwestern United States.
Yes, it will be evacuated. Not entirely.
Right. So
that
is
day is coming.
Yeah, is there a way of looking at conservation? And again, conservation is a slippery slope, because are we conserving to grow, are we conserving to sustain a reasonable and workable level of human populations in an area?
Yeah, which brings up the brilliance of Wallace Stegner. I don't think we can forget about him. And, you know, he did say, he gave a prophecy too in 1985, I think it was, when the reservoirs were full. He did an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, and it said, this arid lands will be the desert oasis it was always meant to be. You know, that's a bold statement to say reservoirs are full. And here's Wallace Stegner saying, this place is going to be depopulated.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're, and he said why, which is we do not know how to work with scarcity, to control our, he said it much better than I am right now.
No, this
is
good.
To limit our demands.
Right. And so I guess that is the fundamental question. You know, are we going to learn to live within our means and work with what we have?
Work with nature.
Yeah, to work with nature.
Be a friend of nature, not a conqueror. I mean, it's the solution. Everybody, what's the solution? That's the solution, Tom. Mm,
yeah.
Respect nature. So that's, and actually, Donald Worster talks about that. He calls it the next great abundance. You know, it'll be different. But he says, you'll be surprised, we would actually be happier. Powell said this, too. No, and it wasn't Powell, it was DeVoto. DeVoto said, we would be happier if we worked with nature. Why are we afraid to go down that way?
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, it's because of our capitalistic impulses.
Mm.
You know, doesn't mean you're going to go hungry.
Right.
Nature is abundant. But at what we're extracting, we're looking at the extinction of a lot of things that we think are precious, that are precious.
Right. Yes.
So it's going, the point is, Tom, it's going to change.
Right.
You know, but we should be a part of the change, not...
Right.
You know, okay, it's going to change. This is what we're going to do.
Uh-huh.
Now, that conversation cannot be had.
Well, it looks as though there is a glimmer of hope here. The people that manage these dams, meaning the Bureau of Reclamation, they have a vested interest to watch this as well.
Yeah.
And to start realizing, maybe we need to rethink this. Do you see that slowly happening within the agency?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's already happened.
Okay.
I think the Bureau's tired of having their chains pulled by the states.
Okay.
And they ultimately do have the authority. I mean, these are, Congress authorized these things.
Right.
For the benefits of the states. Well, the states aren't nice benefactors. They're selfish and self-motivated, and they're just making all the wrong decisions, you know. But the people that get blamed are the feds.
Ah.
And, you know, they're the ones that have to, you know, the Department of Justice goes to court, not the Attorney General of Arizona.
Right.
he'll probably be there on the other side, you know, or she. So, yeah, so the Constitution has this separation of powers to avoid tyranny. But when you have, but you know, there's nothing in the Constitution that addresses the tyranny against nature.
Right, but we do that at our own peril.
Yes.
Nice.
So, the states need to tone their rhetoric down. You know, it's being driven by Chamber of Commerce, real estate people,
mm-hmm.
retail stores, commercial enterprises. That's what's driving this.
Right.
And it's going to go away, period. I mean, it, you know, this is no crystal ball stuff. It's just math. Everybody knows it. But nobody has the guts to have the conversation, except people like you and me.
When do you think people are going to start getting it? I mean, a lot of people are getting it. When do you think the Chamber of Commerce is going to get it? That it's in their best interest to get on board with working with the. You know, the water that we have, there's recent pushes to build yet more dams in the system. So clearly there's another side to this that, you know, they're saying, well, the answer to drought is more dams.
Yeah. Concrete makes water.
Right. Well, they should be saying concrete can hold water if there's water to hold. But if there's no water to hold, then concrete is concrete.
Yeah, it's like cloud seeding without clouds.
Right.
No, that's not the way. But they're out there proposing it.
Right.
California, we need more infrastructure. No, you don't. You need less.
Right.
You know, why don't you put the water in the ground? You've vacated the groundwater. Why don't you refill it?
Well, that's another thing we see the Chamber of Commerce doing is, okay, well, if we don't have water in the basin, through the BOR plumbing, we're just going to keep pumping groundwater. And
yes.
that will only work so long.
Yeah, and it takes 10,000 years to rebuild it. Yeah.
Right. The recharge rates are way slower than the withdrawal rates.
Yeah, and actually that's a bigger deal, Tom. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, that's the surrogate water supply. Our groundwater use is consumption is superior to surface water consumption.
But for how long?
Oh, not, you know, the Ogallala aquifer
right.
is going to be gone in less than 20 years. And they'll be dependent on the Missouri River. Just in time, you know, about the same time that it fills up with sediment. You know, everywhere you go, there's this uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, shit.
All right. Well, there is a movement nationally to remove dams all across the country. There's tens of thousands of dams that were built, low-head hydro dams, et cetera, which served a short-term purpose and then went idle. And a lot of those are starting to be looked at now. For removal, and that's encouraging because it allows us all to look at much larger federal structures, from the Tennessee Valley Authority to Bureau of Reclamation in the West, and all the many hundreds and hundreds of dams that Reclamation built, if not thousands. You know, we as a species are pretty clever about looking at stuff and saying, well, that didn't work. Let's try something else.
we could do it. You know, the epilogue of Donald Worster's book, Rivers of Empire, is a very inspirational chapter. I mean, it should be mandatory reading for anybody who is involved with Colorado River management.
And what does he say?
Work with nature.
Okay.
Don't conquer it. You know, he says we're in a he's actually quoting another famous historian, but we're in a hydraulic trap.
Okay.
And we need to free ourselves. And so we need an emancipation. You know, it was really difficult to get through slavery in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it's going to be like to get out of the hydraulic trap. It's going to be of that epic proportion. You know, and it's going to happen whether we want it or not.
Right. Why?
And so let's just surrender. Let's surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not do this war. Let's just surrender right now and figure out how to do this.
Right.
And it's going to be hard because democracy is messy. You know, but the reason why it's messy is because it's very deliberate and conversational and it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, John Weisheit, that sounds like a very good way to conclude this interview. What do you think?
Yeah. How long has this one been?
We're hour 22.
Oh, that's typical so far.
Not bad. Is there anything else we've missed in our discussions that you would want to bring in? Or have we kind of covered the bases in a broad brush way?
Well, that's a really good question. So the question is what's missing?
I tell you what. Why don't we ponder that with the knowledge that there may be a part 6 to this interview series?
Okay.
All right.
Have you done 6 part interviews before?
I think 13 part is the
13.
I'm sorry, we yeah. Well, I digress.
Who was that with?
I think it was Bob Cornelius, National Park Service law enforcement ranger. Anyway.
Wow.
We should, yeah, it was really fun. And with that, we will go ahead and conclude this part 5 interview with John Weisheit. Today is December 3rd, 2019. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History Series interview. My name is Tom Martin, and John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Have a good day.
You too.